The second case for oral argument this morning is Action Carrier versus United National Insurance Company. I should note that Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Stephen Jensen, a circuit judge in the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. For the appellant, Action Carrier, we have Mr. John Wiles, attorney from Watertown. Welcome. And we have Mr. R. Allen Peterson for the appellee, United National Insurance Company, from Sioux Falls. Welcome. And you have 20 minutes. Mr. Wiles, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're here to determine today whether the trial court committed reversible error in setting aside a default judgment based upon abuse of discretion and clearly erroneous findings of fact. If the trial court is reversed, then it's also necessary to consider the reformation of clerical errors in the default judgment. That issue is moot if you affirm the trial court, and then the issue for determination is whether the trial court committed reversible error in not awarding sanctions and fees. Back in 1992, insurance company by the name of United National entered into a reinsurance and quota share agreement with an Italian insurance company. I do my best by calling it Assoziani Generali, and I'll just refer to it as Generali. The terms of that agreement were that United National would, we later learned, front policies of insurance for Generali. In other words, under the contract, United National would issue policies on its paper, and 100% of the liability, 100% of the responsibility, the management of the policy was ceded to Generali. Nobody knew that. We, in fact, didn't find that out until November 18, 2002, more than a year after the default judgment was taken.
Would the insurance division have known of that?
You know, Your Honor, that's one of the issues that I'm dealing with, is that United National is authorized to do business in this state. I've asked that you take judicial notice of the fact that Assoziani Generali is not. As you look at this issue, I don't think that they had the ability to issue those policies because 100% of the liability was ceded from United National to Generali. In other words, they become the principal, and that's one of the issues that we're here because Judge Sersker of the trial court ignored the issue of agency when he dealt with the ruling on the motion to set aside the default.
Do you think your client is bound by this assignment since they didn't know about it or consent to it?
My point, Your Honor, I don't think it makes a bit of difference because our contract is with United National. We paid them the premiums. We had no idea that Generali was involved in this. Under South Dakota law, they then become an undisclosed agent for Generali as the principal, and they are responsible 100% under our statutes for the actions of their principal, which is Generali. Now, that's where we get into this argument, is when did United National lose its status as a principal and become the agent for Generali? It is our position that once that contract was signed, once they did not retain any rights or liabilities under that contract with Generali, they then became the undisclosed agent. And the proof is in the actions. When the summons and complaint was served on general counsel for United National, he turned around and gave it to the senior claims manager by the name of Gerald Durkin. When we took Durkin's deposition, he said, I didn't log it in, I didn't set up a file, I didn't have anything to do with it because I didn't have any liability in it. I shipped it to a guy by the name of Ron Coleman. I shipped it to him because I knew he was the disclosed agent for Assoziani Generali. If they had anything to do as a principal in this action, they would have had to take some action other than simply shipping it down the road and saying, let me know how this comes out. In the words of Durkin, he told Coleman, make sure you tell Richard March, our general counsel, what happens with this. Just kind of keep him in the loop. It's even more poignant, Your Honor, when we get to February 5 of 2001, when we had the first motion hearing to set aside the default judgment. In the affidavits that were submitted. They don't define what was in New York, to whom they had to ship these documents. In fact, Coleman's affidavit simply identifies John Mahowski, assistant vice president, One Liberty Plaza. Assistant vice president of what? It sure wasn't United National Insurance. Turns out he was assistant vice president for Generali. The affidavit of counsel also does not identify to whom the documents were being sent. Now understand, United National is in Philadelphia. It has nothing to do with New York City. On January 5, we determined that they don't have an office in New York City. They don't have counsel in New York City. The only thing that's in New York City is Associati Generali. And in counsel's affidavit, they'd simply said, we forwarded the papers to the proper office for processing. Like I said earlier, we didn't find out about the fronting agreement until at that hearing, Judge Cirska said, hey, either somebody's not telling the truth, or we need more information. Go get them and bring them here so we can talk to them. That didn't happen because, quite frankly, my motion to compel corporate witnesses in South Dakota got quashed. And then we had to go take depositions in Philadelphia, in New York City, in Richmond, Virginia. That's where we discovered this fronting agreement. And we discovered that United National had nothing to do, no responsibility, no liability to us in this lawsuit. You know what's interesting is if they had assigned this policy to Generali, there would be a paper trail that would establish their relationship. But there wasn't even an assignment of the policy. They didn't even bother with that because they had this quiet contract between them that says, you issue your paper and we'll take care of it from there. You don't have any obligation, and by the way, we'll indemnify you and hold you harmless against anything that happens in this thing. South Dakota law says that if you are a real party in interest, you ought to be involved in a lawsuit. The only defendant in this lawsuit is United National Insurance. Associati Generali has never moved to join this action. The only one we dealt with, the only one we sued, was United National. And we took a default judgment after serving their legal counsel. Now, we're not dealing with a bunch of yo-yos who don't know what they're doing. This action was served on legal counsel for United National Insurance. It was handled by a seasoned insurance adjuster. It was sent to Ron Coleman, who is a lawyer and the senior claims analyst for Associati Generali. And it was then sent again, after he analyzed it, to Mahowski in New York City. These are not little businessmen that don't know what they're doing. Under the circumstances, what is apparent to us, and I'm arguing in the alternative because I don't really think I need to, I think United National dropped the ball. I think they're an undisclosed agent, and I really don't care what happened in their contractual problems between them and Ron Coleman and Generali. Those are their issues. Not mine. I don't have privity of contract with Coleman, and I certainly don't have privity of contract with Generali.
Well, but isn't that why they're saying there's excusable neglect in this case? Is because United's saying because of these contractual relationships and business relationships, we should be excused from normally responding to this in a timely fashion. Isn't that why it is your problem?
No, it isn't, because in our deposition of Coleman, or excuse me, of Durkin, he said, I don't care. It's not my problem. We have this agreement. It goes to Generali. I don't care. I didn't log it in. It's not my problem. So he's not even claiming excusable neglect. It's Generali that is. And if you look at the briefs, it's interesting the way the law.
But he sent it timely.
He sent it timely to Ron Coleman. It was served on the 21st of September. He got it and analyzed it on the 27th of September and shipped it to Coleman on the 28th of September. Coleman analyzed it and turned around and shipped it to Mahowski on the same day. Now, Mahowski, Your Honor, is in New York City, and he looked at that lawsuit on September 4. He looked at it again on October 12. On October 12, he sent a missile back to Coleman following his policy that said, send me the policy. I'm doing my due diligence. That's on October 12. We didn't take a default judgment until November 9th. You know, we live in a small fishbowl in South Dakota, and you don't just run to the courthouse and grab a default judgment because it'll come back and haunt you. Something, usually there's an explanation. But from September 21, when that was served, okay, not only did Generali, not only did United National know about it, not only did the senior claims analyst Coleman know about it, not only did Mahowski know about it, but he was taking action on that file on October 12th.
When was the first time you found out or your client found out about the existence of Generali? Did you know about this going on?
We had no idea, Your Honor, about Generali until November 18th, 1982, when we took Durkin's deposition.
No, you said 1982, you mean?
Excuse me, 92. Excuse me, 2000.
Okay,
started in 2001, excuse me.
All right.
Okay, in 2000.
About a year later, after all this is going back and forth, you finally find out Generali's out there.
Correct.
All right.
Okay, otherwise we'd include in a lawsuit.
Mr. Wells, I can't recall right now. I don't recall seeing anything in the record about giving notice of intent to take that default judgment.
There's been no answer.
Did you serve notice of intent to take a default on anybody?
If there was an appearance, Your Honor, of any kind, we would have.
I understand the rule. I'm just wondering if you did it out of caution or...
No, we figured after 60 days if they hadn't showed up, they were being non-responsive. And that's when we took the default judgment.
And refresh my memory, there were some attempts to negotiate the thing before it was sued out, weren't there?
I believe there were, yes. But, you know, we try to play by the rules on this thing. And we didn't run in after 30 days and get a default judgment. We didn't run in after 60 days. But by then we figured, where are these people? Nobody showed up. Nobody called. Nobody did anything. On October 12th, when Mahowski is sitting in his office in New York City, and for the second time looking at the summons and complaint served on September 1, and he's got all the correspondence, and he's got the summons, he's got the complaints, he's got the transmittal from March to the South Dakota Secretary of State, he's got the transmittal from Durkin to Coleman, he's got Coleman's analysis of the file on October 12th. He didn't call anybody. He didn't call us to say, hey, we got a problem back here. He didn't look to Coleman, who he considers to be one whale of a third-party administrator, and say, I need some help here. You've been my sole representative for 15 years. You're a lawyer. You know how to handle this. Get in touch with somebody. Help me. What he did, believe it or not, was assign the claim to a guy by the name of Philippi. He worked 2.5 days a week. He's a part-time claims adjuster. On October 12th, there's no way in the world he didn't know he was in default. And he did absolutely nothing for another 38 days until November 28th. Where were these people? They are not bumpkins that don't know what they're doing. And the big thing about it is they darn well knew, in spite of September 11th, what was going on. They just dropped the ball. And it blows my mind, but United National says, under the contract, we don't have any issues. We don't have any authority. We don't have to. Coleman says the same thing under his service agreement. I'm not going to go there. In fact, Coleman describes Generali as a multinational insurance company with more money than they know what to do with. Why would I be telling them what to do? It's not my deal. In South Dakota, if you're an agent, you are deemed to have given your information to your principal. If you are an undisclosed agent, you are held to be responsible as the principal. Notwithstanding everything that went on in New York, we think that standing alone is negligent, and it doesn't rise even to the low standard that we have previously established in Smith, Elliott, Arroso, and Upper Plains.
What findings of fact would we have to determine are clearly erroneous, and what did you propose that was not accepted? I assume you objected to certain...
We objected to the proposed findings of fact that were submitted by the defendant.
Which particularly? I mean, there's a lot of things that are not in dispute. There weren't the meritorious defense, for instance. that the damages were incorrectly, or the percentage was incorrectly. I mean, some of those you obviously didn't object to necessarily, but I'm assuming you objected to the one that says that the Office of Defendant's Reinsurer, with whom they had the contractual relationship, was responsible for the defense. Did you object to that one?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
And what would you have proposed instead?
What I said there was it wasn't the agents of United National that were in New York City. It was their principal.
Okay, so the reinsurer part is not what you don't agree with Judge Sirska's interpretation of it being a reinsurer?
Oh, I do agree that they have a contract. But what they characterized the reinsurer, Generali, as is being the agent of United National. I don't believe that to be a correct statement, Your Honor.
Well, it doesn't. Did Judge Sirska actually say that in this finding?
Yes, he did.
Did he use the word agent?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's, I believe, in the settled record. It's about 80, 83, somewhere in there.
Okay.
We not only objected to those findings, but we also proposed our own findings, which were much more definitive in terms of the relationship between United National and Generali, and in fact outlined specifically the timeline and the interaction that took place. But yeah, we have never, when we get to the issue of meritorious defense, I would agree with Judge Sirska that there's a meritorious defense on the issue of statute of limitations and on contract. But beyond that, I do not disagree with him, and we have objected to his findings. In fact, in the ruling of the court on January 5, 2004, he as much said that the issue of the judgment at 12% was not something that amounted to a meritorious defense, but more something that needed to be addressed. And in that hearing, he went so far as to say, well, I know the issue of agency is there, but I'm going to ignore it for right now and fine for the defendant on the issue of excusable neglect. I think that was wrong. I think that resulted in us then filing our affidavit for fees and costs, to which counsel said, well, I want to object to that. So then we filed further briefs on the issue, along with our objections. Everybody objected to everything. And
so,
on February...
let me just follow along that before I forget then. What you are asking us, are you asking that if we would reverse, that we would send it back for the judge to address the agency question?
No. I think that's part of the error. I think he ignored the agency question, and he found that the agents of United National were Generali. I think it's just the flip-flop. And he didn't get so far as to analyze that relationship. The finding of fact that's of record says that United National's agents in New York City, and that's an incorrect statement of the facts in the case.
Well, Mr. Wilds, you know, that really brings us, I think, to the fundamental issue, and that is, do the rules of agency strictly control the outcome of relief from a default judgment? Our cases suggest that you simply look at what a reasonable person would do, and even if there may be some legal technicalities under the rules of agency that would apply here, we still have to fall back. I mean, it seems to me that Judge Sirska was probably just saying, well, you might have a technical point on agency, but I've got to look at what a reasonable person would do. And in light of what happened on September 11th, it doesn't seem unreasonable.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully disagree, and because of Michalski's knowledge. I mean, we have all of these players in here who are sophisticated insurance people and lawyers. And Michalski is the guy in New York City, and he is aware of the summons and complaint on September 4th. He's dealing with Coleman again on October 11th. He's analyzing it on October 12th, and then he continues to do nothing in spite of his knowledge. Now,
that's a reasonableness question. That's not an agency question.
That's a reasonableness question if you consider him to be the agent of United National. If he is the principal, that's another question. Our argument, Your Honor, is that we never knew about these guys. If we had, we'd have made them party to the lawsuit. But they hid that from us, and they hid it for a long period of time. The only party that's here as a defendant is United National. That's the one we dealt with. They never said boo, sic 'em, anything about having to be responsible to anybody else. Never once. And even when we took their deposition, they claimed zero responsibility because they had already contracted it away. That's when our argument starts and says they lost their status as a principal. Now they become the undisclosed agent for the folks that they sold all of their rights to. And under South Dakota law, that undisclosed agent is the guy I'm dealing with. I don't know about anybody else. And my responsibility is only to deal and rely on him to answer this lawsuit.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Your time has expired. Mr. Peterson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Action Carrier is desperately trying to hold on to a judgment that they know they can't duplicate if they get to the point of a trial on the merits. They've already conceded that the judgment that they received was in error. United National simply asked that the decision of Judge Sertzka be affirmed and that this be sent back for a trial on the merits. I begin just addressing the simple question of agency because I think that question confuses the rest of the issue. You know, the principal in this case, the company that issued the policy and clearly has primary responsibility, is United National. Now, they did have a reinsurer, and there's no conspiracy. I mean, South Dakota and insurance practice in general regularly has reinsurers. The reinsurer in this case is Generali. Generali also had an agent, a third-party administrator by the name of Ron Coleman, who lived in Virginia. These parties had an ongoing relationship and had had that relationship for some time. It had been a very functional relationship that had provided insurance, obviously it provided profit for the company or they wouldn't have been continuing it, and it provided insurance to a South Dakota company. And if there's a question of who is the agent, I ask the question, if Generali goes bankrupt or into receivership, is that going to prevent United National from being responsible on this policy? Well, clearly not. United National wrote the policy, and they are the principal who will be responsible. The policy or the procedure that this court has usually issued examines a number of things, and I'll talk about the timeline as I apply to that. But the standard of review, of course, is very important in this case to me and to my client, and I particularly turn to the language of the Elliott case, because that is the case that says that no abuse of discretion occurs if no judicial mind, in view of the law and circumstances of the particular case, could reasonably have reached the same conclusion. And that is the standard of review I would ask you to apply. And that is to look at the facts as Judge Sertzka was looking at them and simply ask yourself, could a reasonable judge come to the same conclusion and decide that this case should be tried on the merits? I think in light of that standard, the answer has to be yes. The Smith case articulated the fact that doubt is to be resolved in favor of a trial on the merits. A default judgment is an extreme, a drastic measure. It's punitive in nature, only for a totally unresponsive party. Applying that standard, I think Judge Sertzka's decision is fully acceptable. The court has established a legal standard that asks if there is a meritorious defense and excusable neglect. And in this case, I'm not even sure there's neglect, but I'll accept for the purposes of the argument that there was neglect on the part of United National in some sense. But their course of action was quite simple. First of all, on the 16th of August of 2001, service was admitted by the Division of Insurance. It was faxed to United National. 5 days later, the senior vice president of United National responded back to the Division of Insurance and said, "Are you sure this counts as service? You've named the wrong party. The correspondence you've given to us is directed to United National Specialties Company, and we are United National Insurance Company." And apparently responding, the Division of Insurance, I assume, responded and said, yes, service is effective, because Mr. March then turned it over to Mr. Durkin, and Mr. Durkin in the Philadelphia office then examined it and decided that this was a policy that was applied under the reinsurance with Generali. Pursuant to his instruction, as he explained, he faxed it to Mr. Coleman, the administrative or the third-party agent for Generali. Mr. Coleman looked at it and realized this was not a claim under the policy for damages, but rather was a direct action that named the insurance company itself in the nature of a bad faith action or a bigger contract dispute. He knew that according to their course of action, his responsibility was to send that to New York City to the office of Mr. Makowski. Excuse me.
Just take the glass up there with you if you'd like.
So far, there's been anything but neglect. It came to United National. They immediately took action. Within 10 days, they send it to the third-party administrator. That very same day, we're now 11 days after service, it's sent to the New York office of the person who will be in charge of arranging a defense or settlement of this suit. Mr. Makowski took a look at that action. He was busy for a couple of days and didn't get a chance to deal with it because of Labor Day and some other business occupational calendar commitments. He put this on September 4th in his to-do basket for his return on the 12th of September. He had 5 days before an answer was due, and he testifies he had every reason in the world to believe he would have dealt with it when he got back on the 12th. Unfortunately, because of the World Trade Center bombings, he did not get back on the 12th. His office is across the street. His building was under armed guards. And you have the exhibits before you that show the picture of our National Guardsmen with rifles preventing people from entering that building. The devastation of his office building with the broken windows and the debris everywhere. This is an unusual case in that the default in answering isn't one of carelessness, but rather Mr. Makowski being physically prevented from accessing his office. Now, if United National were to have followed up at that time when the answer was due, what would they have done? Would they have called Mr. Makowski to find out what the status was? Where would they have gotten a hold of him? He was still on the West Coast trying to catch an airplane to get back home so he could attend to business.
Is that all in the record?
I believe so, yeah. Your Honor, I believe the deposition establishes that he was on the West Coast.
Isn't the argument, though, that they should have had some kind of a tickler system to, and rather than just pass it on and ignore it from then on?
I think that is the argument that the plaintiff wants to make. And I'll accept, you know, for the purpose of the argument, that they should have had a tickler system. But they didn't. They had a 10-year course of dealing where there had never been a problem. And under the reasonable standard, the reasonable course of action standard, I don't think there's anything that is inexcusable about them not having had these backup systems. Now, it isn't the first time this court has examined cases under default that have been passed on to an adjuster. In what I, for shorthand, call the Pepsi case, the United Plains contracting case that Judge Sinter wrote the opinion on. It was a case where the suit papers had been turned over to a third-party administrator, and the party understood that administrator would be handling the defense, and the court found that excusable on the part of the principal. In the Rosso case, again, the insured did not pass suit papers on to the insurance company, but had passed them on one or more similar lawsuits and believed that their insurance company was taking care of all the suits, multiple suits out of the same event. And again, the default was set aside. In the Davis decision, again, insurance papers were turned over to an insurance company and the insurer did not get the defense prepared and an answer admitted in time. And in each of those cases, the court looked at the equities and found that there was a reasonable excuse, that there was excusable neglect, and the default was set aside.
You're arguing that there was basically a physical inability for Makowski, I think it was, to respond to this suit. I think Judge Cirska found that. But what about the facts? You've got, I think it's early October 11th, 12th, somewhere in there. Isn't it Makowski admits he found the suit papers, saw the suit papers, called the third-party administrator about them, and then we have another almost month goes by, and there's no answer filed. He didn't apparently attempt to get a hold of the plaintiff. He didn't attempt to get it assigned or anything like that. What's the explanation for that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure the record's quite as clear as it was portrayed in terms of what Mr. Makowski might have seen at that time. Mr. Makowski described a situation where he went into his then ramshackled office, stuffed as much as he could in a briefcase, grabbed another foot of paper, and was escorted again out of the building. He was given 1.5 hours to be in his office. From that time, operating out of 3 different conference rooms in law firms and wherever else they could find space, they began the process of sorting. And, you know, Mr. Makowski tells what is probably a tale of woe, but he said, look, my life was devastated. He talks about co-workers being killed, people they knew. You know, it captivated the whole world, and now we're sitting here 5 years down the road, and it doesn't quite seem to have the same dramatic impact as it did then. But the truth of the matter is, Makowski, like most other people, was having a hard time getting on with business as normal. And I'll accept that as his excuse, and I hope that you find that to be excusable as well. That he was dealing with business, he was trying to get to it, but it didn't get done. And I would also point out that the default judgment in this matter was taken in November, but not served until the 27th of November. And it wasn't the notice of the default that spurred action in this case, because the very next day, the file came to my law firm, and as Mr. Wiles indicates in his briefing, on the 30th of November, he was first contacted by counsel from my office to see what the status of the case was, to see whether it was default and if the default would be excused and whether we could just proceed with the lawsuit at that point. The notice of default judgment was mailed to a stale address and did not come to United National at that address. That was established in Mr. Durkin's deposition. So it wasn't as if United National, through its agent, was simply ignoring the situation. Could it have done something more diligently? Could it have gotten to it, this case, as opposed to one of the other 150 cases that was in that stack of paper earlier? Well, perhaps. But it certainly is not inexcusable in this situation to act as they did. And on their own initiative, they appeared in this lawsuit and made it proceed. Now, in addition to the excusable neglect, this court has regularly looked at the timeliness or the dilatory behavior almost in a punitive situation. And I think it's instructive to look at the cases where a default is not set aside, as well as where it liberally has been set aside. And I'm going to call to the court's attention 3 cases because I think they illustrate what the court has used as the liberal standard. And the first case I'm going to refer to is the Ladson case, and because this was not cited in the brief, I point out it's a 2004 SD 74, June 2004, where a default was issued against the person who, after several warnings, never got a lawyer for a corporate representation. And the court found, and I believe it was Chief Justice Gilbertson wrote that opinion, that in this case the default was not inappropriate. There, after repeated warnings, the default would not be set aside. In the Estes decision, again a 2004 decision that unfortunately was not cited in the briefing, but I called attention to a 2004 SD 49 in the Estes versus Ashley Hospitality,
We had a plaintiff who knew about hearings and intentionally didn't come to the hearing and basically is flaunting the legal system, in addition to having no meritorious defense. Or in the Strub case, which is cited in the brief at 427 Northwest 2nd, 836, where we have a lawyer who just out and out flaunts the system, refuses to come to hearings, doesn't show up for trial, disobeys the court's order, and finally a default is entered and the court says there's no defense, no meritorious defense, and in combination with the lack of excusable neglect, the decision to not set aside the default is granted. So I think when we look at the liberal interpretation or the attempt to have a trial on the merits, in this case, the merits are worth hearing. And I call that to the court's attention because even though it's not usually listed as one of the elements, certainly one of the factors that is always considered is the strength of the merits. And in the Pepsi case, Judge Zinter specifically said that even a willful default can be set aside on the strength of the merits. There was a $17,000 error that warranted setting aside the default judgment. Here we have a $40,000 error in the judgment, admitted, that has to be set aside. Here we have a meritorious defense in the statute of limitations on the face of the complaint. The complaint itself says the course of action between these parties was done in 1994, and yet they do not sue out the contract action for over six years. It's 7 years before they sue it out. On the face of the complaint, the statute of limitations is passed. I'm not going to address the notion of the sanctions of the clerical error unless the court specifically would want me to. I don't believe those are properly before the court, and I hope that you will never get to those. Applying the standard of review of looking at most favorably what we're looking at and finding whether there was reason that the judge could have found that there was excusable neglect, I hope that you will affirm that decision. Send this back for a trial on the merits and let the parties have their day in court.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Wiles, you have 10 minutes, sir.
This case has taken some very interesting twists and turns as we've gone through the discovery needed to reasonably get the information to the court so that it could make its decision. When it first came on for hearing, that information wasn't available. And that's why Judge Cirska sent us to find the information that we've just discussed with you. In making his decision on excusable neglect, in his hearing on January 15th of 2004, he said, well, we know that the issue of agency exists, but I'm not going to deal with it right now. We'll deal with it later. And that was wrong, because it significantly affects the reason that we're here. He also, at that hearing, received a motion for sanctions with an affidavit, which counsel wanted to argue, so we did. And that argument continued until we hadn't heard from the judge on anything, and both of us sent him letters. And after he issued the decision on the excusable neglect issue, then we issued a memorandum decision dealing with the attorney fees and costs. Counsel would argue that that is not a final order. Perhaps the order should have said supplemental order. It didn't. But it was argued and presented on the same day, on the same terms and the same conditions, and the heading and the style of that order reflects that. If this court finds that excusable neglect does exist, then it ought to impose such sanctions as it believes are reasonable. And those sanctions should deal with the what it took to get the information to the court. And citing the Knapp case, as counsel has in their brief, that's correct, and that's exactly what we did. They didn't come to court with sufficient evidence to establish excusable neglect. and we therefore had to go get it to the judge. If you don't find excusable neglect, and I think you will and should, that issue is something you can avoid. But excusable neglect is what a prudent person would do under similar circumstances. We've said that since in each one of the cases up through the last Upper Plains. Excusable neglect, though, has to be something that you would expect someone to deal with properly. Here we have United National, who's our insurance company, and they have absolutely done nothing, zero, to defend this action. Durkin just shipped it off. That was the extent of his involvement. Coleman didn't even log the file in either. I can only imagine what my malpractice carrier would do to me if I didn't log in the litigation that crosses my desk and that involves me or my clients. Neither one of these guys did. But when we talk about the trauma of September 11th and how it affects Mahowski, I understand that. But what I don't understand is that in October, when he knew about all of this and he talked to Coleman, why didn't he tell Coleman to help him? Why didn't he tell Coleman to call the Actions Council or to do something? Why didn't he talk to United National on the issue? He did nothing. He did absolutely nothing. Now, we took the default judgment more than 60 days after they had been absolutely non-responsive. It's kind of fair. We didn't rush in and grab one just because they weren't there. We even delayed noticing the entry of it to see if somebody would show up. But none of that happened. So when we get to an analysis of all the cases that you've decided on excusable neglect, there has to be some reasonable standard that somebody has to be held accountable for. And you've talked about overworked small businessmen, and you've talked about failing to get it to lawyers, and you've talked about lots of issues, but you have never talked about insurance professionals in the business doing absolutely nothing in spite of their knowledge. If you find excusable neglect, then I think it is also absolutely necessary that you find that Judge Sirska was wrong when he found that miscalculation of interest is a meritorious defense. It's not. This is a two-part question. If Judge Sirska had found excusable neglect, then we would have moved to amend the judgment because it needs to be reformed to correctly reflect the 10% interest. But it's not like the Wolf case, where you're trying to determine child support based upon deviations. You have an absolute number, an absolute date certain, and all you need to do is apply the right interest rate. And that's harmless error under 15660, which is a clerical error, and under 15661, which is harmless error. By abusing the appropriate interest rate in this case, two things happen. One, there has been no detriment to United National because they've never paid a dime yet. And two, the calculation saves them a whole bunch of money, so it's their betterment to make that adjustment. You can do it here under the rules, under the statutes, or you can remand it back to Judge Sirska and have him do the same thing. That issue is secondary, however, to the finding that excusable neglect exists. So.
Well, Mr. Wells, before you go on, it's come up a couple times this morning, whether the meritorious defense is technically an issue in this appeal. Frankly, after I'd read the briefs, I had come to the conclusion it was not.
And I agree with you.
Okay.
Okay. It's, the only reason it is because of the characterization of the miscalculation of judgment of interest and the judgment being meritorious defenses. That's the only reason that they were argued. Under the circumstances, the order setting aside should be reversed, because if you don't, the standard for setting aside a default judgment in South Dakota has just disappeared. and we might as well not even have that as an issue. You have to, at some point, be responsible. You have to take some degree of reasonable action to protect yourself. And as I've argued, we really don't think that the issues between Coleman and Generali and United have anything to do with us. Our only contact, our only known party that we're dealing with is United National. Had we known about this other relationship, had they assigned the contract just like you sign a mortgage so that you know who you're dealing with, had they done anything to put us on notice, we would have made Associazione Generale a real party in interest in this litigation. Because under their contract with United National, they've assumed 100% of the liability, 100% of the responsibility, and have agreed to stand tall and take any judgment that comes down against United National. We believe that Judge Cirska has abused his discretion. We believe that there is clearly erroneous findings of fact and conclusions of law. And under the circumstances, we believe that the default judgment, the motion for the order to set it aside, should be reversed, and that this court should either, on its own, under the statutes, amend the judgment to correctly reflect the interest rate, or to remand it to Judge Cirska for him to do that. In the alternative, if you decide to do neither one of those, then the issue of terms needs to be addressed. We incurred one whale of a lot of expense to get the information to Judge Cirska. We tried to get the depositions in South Dakota. They quashed them. They invited us to go to New York City and to Philadelphia on one trip, but we couldn't coordinate with Mr. Coleman, so we had to go back a second time to Richmond, Virginia. Those expenses were all incurred in a reasonable effort to determine the basis for the default, not to defend it, but for them to put enough information before the court to make that ruling. Our request for fees and costs is extraordinary based on prior decisions, but the affidavit is very precise about what's in there. You can't get something unless you ask for it, and that's why that affidavit is as thorough as it is. Thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to address these issues because some of them are kind of a first impression.
Thank you, Mr. Wiles. The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.